age theory. And blood reproduction. So just to remind where we were last time, what we had last time was we saw how to go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian picture by using the Euler Lagrange equations. We saw how to go back by using a first order picture. And then these two Lagrangian pictures were related by removing auxiliary fields. But so far, the analysis was limited to pretty simple theories like scalar field theories. And of course, most of the time, you might be interested in more complicated things like gauge theories. So today, I want to study what the Hamiltonian picture will look like for gauge theories, but still keeping to the very simple case of just one time dimension with no space.
My notes are a bit of a mess.
So, I think Giuseppe explained if I have a Lie algebra acting on a symplectic manifold. Then, suppose we take a basis of this Lie algebra. So I'm not sure what how much algebra you guys have studied. So is this something you're familiar with? Yeah, okay. So suppose we have such a Lie algebra acting on a symplectic manifold, PC, then there exists Noether charges, Noether currents, UA, which are functions on the symplectic manifold, which satisfy UA, UB equals FABC, UC. So they satisfy the same commutational relations except now using the Poisson bracket. And a function on my manifold, M to OR, transforms by a Poisson bracket. F gets sent to F plus UA. The infinitesimal transformation. Okay, this is how Giuseppe stated it, right? Or
not quite.
Not
do you approve action?
Well,
he thinks a bit differently.
Oh, sorry, I should have checked over the notes. I thought, how did you state it, Giuseppe?
So it's pretty much the same idea. So what we did is we started with a group action.
Mm-hmm.
Then from the group action and the algebra element, we associated to it a vector field.
Yes.
On the manifold.
Uh-huh.
And then we just had the action of the vector field on a function, which is what you just wrote with the delta f. It just didn't write it in terms of the Poisson brackets.
Great, but you didn't. So the thing you didn't explain was that the vector field comes from a Hamiltonian. Is that right?
So we kind of went the other way around. We started with the group action. We constructed the vector field, and then we say that if the vector field happens to be an Hamiltonian vector field, then the function it comes from is conserved.
Okay. Okay. Great. So this should be close enough to what Giuseppe said that you can follow it, right? And we'll also see it in examples.
Next tutorial, I can try to bridge the gap between the two things.
Okay. Yeah. Be like super careful. This story works best if omega is the alpha and the group action doesn't preserve just omega, it preserves alpha. Okay, so this is one formulation of Noether's theorem in quantum mechanics. Of course, Noether's theorem is incredibly general. So what I want to explain is, suppose we have a Lagrangian with the gauge symmetry. How does the gauge symmetry emerge on this side? And it's going to emerge in terms of these Noether curves.
Wait, mm-hmm. Did you use a curly D there for F? Are you trying to not confuse it with something else?
I'm just, the variation. A kind of poetical D. I don't know.
Okay.
Are the Noether currents vectors now, or?
Well, I think just the way Giuseppe. Let's see. If I have a group action, then you on any manifold, you always get a vector field because that's what it means. It's me. That's what it means to have an infinitesimal symmetry. But the special thing about a symplectic manifold is that vector field comes from a function. So remember, when we had this discussion of the Hamiltonian, we said, given a function f, for example, the Hamiltonian, there's a corresponding vector field such that xf contracted into the symplectic form is df. And then xf of g is the Poisson bracket of f and g. So the vector field x mu a generates the symmetry. Associated to our Lie algebra element. So to have a symmetry means we have a vector field. Noether's theorem says that actually the symmetry comes from a charge, which is mu a.
And oh, sorry.
Well, no. I just wanted to remark that maybe one way to see it is if you take in the second line xf, if you remove the g, if you leave one slot in the Poisson bracket open, and you can see that the vector field is induced. Well, yeah, out of the function. Well, I don't know. I'm making it more complicated, but. So, yeah, the f induces the vector field, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, there's the formula in coordinates is like xf is df dpi qi minus. UI, yeah, in coordinates. Yep.
Sorry, maybe this was talked about already, but why do the charges satisfy those anti-commutation limits?
These relations?
Yes.
Okay, so. So that comes from, so if I have an action of the group, you want your vector fields, like to say you have an infinitesimal action means that your vector fields satisfy analogous commutation relations. So if G acts on M means that, I'm just going to call them XA, these vector fields satisfy this relation. So, for example, I think it would clarify things a little bit. If I wrote out an example. So, for example, my Lie algebra, this is an example I will continue to use. It's the group of S1. So this is n by n anti-symmetric matrices. The symplectic form is dpi wedge dpi as usual. So I will get back to explaining this in a second. So then I can take, if I take my north recurrence, U I J E U I E J. E I. Then, according to this formula, the vector fields look like PJPI like this kind of thing. I suppose those four terms. Okay, so what's going on? All that's happening is I look at the Qs, these vector fields, they just rotate the Qs and they rotate the Ps, like ordinary rotational symmetries. And I've built them from this Hamiltonian, or from these quantities here. And maybe, I don't know, maybe this expression shouldn't be surprising to you if you've studied angular momentum. Okay.
Why did you call it Hamiltonian? It's
angular momentum. I misspoke. Hamiltonian as well. Yeah, it's the current for angular momentum. And so what you ask, so we asked, why is that relation hold? So we need the following fact about Poisson brackets. If I have two vector fields, if I have a function, I can build a vector field xf. The commutator of the vector fields is equal to the vector field associated with the Poisson bracket. So if I want my vector fields to satisfy the correct relations, then my Poisson brackets better satisfy those relations too. Is this board here visible, or is it too in the shape?
I think it's visible.
It's visible, okay.
We'll see.
Wait, the bottom or the top one?
What's it?
The top one is the one we can't see.
The top one is the one you can't see. Oh, because of the lights?
Yeah.
Okay, well, so. I'll just use two of them now. So the result we're going to find is, suppose we have a Lagrangian system. With G symmetry. So suppose, let's consider gauging. So one has to be careful because the phrase gauging a symmetry has two different meanings in physics, and you sometimes people mean coupling to a background gauge field. And sometimes people mean coupling to a dynamical gauge field. Those are very different, so we always have to be clear what we're doing. Here I mean couple to a background gauge field. So this means derivatives become covariant derivatives. So that's all that coupling to a background gauge field means. We have a gauge field A. These are one forms on time. And all derivatives are replaced by covariant derivatives. So you can ask, what does this mean on the Hamiltonian side? On the Hamiltonian side. And the answer is, what happens is, the Hamiltonian H from my phase space or is replaced by H plus this expression. When I couple to a gauge field, my all I'm doing is this gauge field is coupled to these Noether currents on the Hamiltonian side.
Sorry, what was your notation of, so I guess it's a one form. Does that mean a real component, or it takes a vector to the reals, or what?
Oh, so I was being a little sloppy. I think it'll be more clear in a sec, but what you should think is, you know, you have a Lagrangian in your field is a vector,
uh-huh.
And this is a matrix.
Okay.
And covariant derivative is ordinary derivative plus multiplied by that matrix.
What did you mean by AA is an element of?
So maybe instead of writing it AA, I'm going to write it as AIJ.
So the components are elements of what's this?
This is the space of one. Oh, did you not use this notation with Giuseppe? This is the space of one forms.
Yeah, but then what does it mean, one form? What's the parentheses reals?
It's a one form on the on this manifold on the real numbers.
Oh, okay.
Is it the manifold is just time?
Okay. Okay.
So I mean, it looks like, you know, because I can treat it as a function for each value of time. That it's a matrix.
So can you explain the example here? What was the because I think Dovid asked why do we have that commutation relation?
Mm-hmm.
And he gave this example, but I didn't quite get the point.
I think I wanted to write out this example to indicate that. Maybe I didn't get all the signs right or something. That if I consider just ordinary rotations as you would expect them to act on position and momentum. Mm-hmm. That's this vector field. Well, those ordinary rotations obviously satisfy this commutation relation, because there's rotations. And I wanted to point out that actually they come in this way from this current.
Because we have this commutation relation, we have that anti-commutation
relation. The notation is bad. This is not an anti-commutation relation. The curly bracket symbol is used for two different things.
It's a Poisson
bracket. It's a Poisson bracket.
So the Poisson bracket gives you the...
Yeah.
Ah.
So you can see this. If you look at that formula, x of f, for f, how you build x of f in terms of f, if you just check, what is the commutator of x of f with x of g? You'll find this by like the two-line manipulation.
Oh.
And you can kind of see why, because if I insert, there's going to be a derivative of f and a derivative of g contracted in some way.
Wait, I'm not sure I understand the notation that it's like the vector field of the Poisson bracket of f and g. What's the notation?
So f and g are functions. So the Poisson bracket of f and g is a new function.
Right, okay.
And then I can use that formula to build a new vector field from this function.
Wait, sorry, isn't the, that's f and g, okay. Oh. Wait a second, no, I'm not entirely sure. So the Poisson bracket is like that, but we have a g there where there would be a blank space, and then you would take that function.
Yeah.
Where the f is.
Exactly, like fg is like lf g. So qi minus, uh-huh. Then we take this whole thing.
And you plug it into that.
Plug it into that expression for f.
Okay.
And you'll find it's the same as this.
Got you. Okay, cool, thank you.
Can you talk about a geometrical picture here a little bit, that why haven't we had Lagrangian column to the gauge field differently? Like, I don't exactly see, like, not in the mathematical way that we can, like, move to here. Yeah, like, on the
I think I was going to go through an example, which I think will clarify, but the way you should think about it, like, when I couple to a background gauge field and changing all of my derivatives to time derivatives. And since the Hamiltonian is what, that tells me how I differentiate stuff. The Hamiltonian tells me how I move in time. If I'm like, if I'm adding on, if every time I see a derivative, I add on this term, then clearly I'm changing the Hamiltonian by something depending on A.
Whenever we're changing by some amounts, we're changing actually with some A, and why charge appears here?
Right, so let's see. So let's remember the time derivative is the vector field associated to the Hamiltonian by this thing. That's how something moves in time. Now, when we add on this term to the Hamiltonian, the new time derivative is the original time derivative plus and what's this telling us? When I take a point in my phase space and evolve it in time, it's going to evolve according to its initial rules of the Hamiltonian, plus how it transforms under these symmetries. So for example, suppose my initial Hamiltonian was zero, and I'm studying, you know, some particle on Rn. What this is saying is that, well, my particle will evolve just by, you know, rotations governed by this symmetry. So it's like saying your particle is in some kind of field forcing it to move around.
So you might have already explained this, but you know, I don't quite understand the connection between the nether currents and when we gauging the Hamiltonian. Did someone just ask that?
That was, yeah, it's not obvious. Yeah, I feel like I don't have a very slick answer for that. I mean, it seems like a natural thing to do. I mean, as we see, we're changing the time derivative, so we're changing the Hamiltonian in some way.
Okay.
And it turns out if you compute it, this is how it changes.
Okay.
These XA are related to our mu A through the symplectic form, right?
There's yes.
Associated.
Exactly, yes.
And then I guess the XA are the generators of our symmetry. Like
exactly. I want to go to an example, which is what I always want to do. Go on.
If XA is the vector and mu A is the function,
yes.
I don't see how the term that we are adding to a Hamiltonian can be a function, and the term that we are adding to a vector, like, I would think that they would be the opposite.
No, I mean, the Hamiltonian is a function on phase space, so I'm adding on a function.
But isn't a one form?
It's
a one form somewhere.
It's a one form on time.
Okay.
So for this expression, I'm going to assume that AA is just kind of ADT, and A is constant on. It's just independent of t. For simplicity, just to start off with. So we have a constant background gauge field, and that changes the Hamiltonian by forcing our point in phase space to move along the orbits of the symmetry.
But like so far, whenever we talk about gauge field, we don't really associate any charge to them. Like we separate gauge from symmetry. But like in this picture, I feel that things are mixed up. I don't really like. Can always think about gauge fields as symmetries?
Yes, gauge fields are always associated.
Like, yeah. You know, associating charge to them. We don't like converge of charge for gauge.
Yes. Yeah. Gauge symmetries are always associated. You know. I have some system with some symmetry and associate some continuous symmetry. When I have continuous symmetry, I'm allowed to couple to a gauge field. So.
But like we don't have a charge for diffeomorphism, for example, or I don't know. Gauge symmetry Maxwell equation.
Well, the gauge symmetry Maxwell's equations is just the electric charge.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So. If I have the Maxwell theory, I have the gauge group is U1. My fields have some integer charge. They're charged under U1. And for a field of charge n, I put a factor of n here when I replace derivative by covariant derivative. And if you were to do that, you would find how your electron couples to a background photon or something.
If we like, if we somehow formulated electromagnetism gauge fixed all the way, we wouldn't have a charge. Like if we didn't have that gauge redundancy, we wouldn't have a charge.
No, it's just well, when you know. That the photon has a gauge symmetry, when I want to talk about coupling that U1 gauge field to matter, you need to tell how the matter fields transform under that gauge symmetry. And those, that transformation property just is the electric charge.
But why do you if they don't make any physical difference? If, like, you know, transforming under the gauge symmetry gives you no new physical results, why do we actually need to look at how they transform?
I mean, it does give you a physical result. You know, we know.
Here so far, the group action we're talking about are global actions, right?
Yes.
Is it a gauge symmetry or is it a global?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, right? That the charge, the conserved currents are associated to the global symmetry, and we're by gauging it, we're coupling the gauge field to the charges of the already present global symmetry.
Yes. But, I mean, you know, in practice, when I have a global symmetry, by replacing derivative by covariant derivative, it becomes a local symmetry. Because I've introduced, the point of introducing the gauge field A is that the gauge field A transforms in a way involving the derivatives of the gauge transformation. And that absorbs the failure of my original symmetry not to be a local symmetry. So let's try and do a really simple example. Suppose I have ii, which are n one-dimensional free fields. These have an SON action. And the Lagrangian is, for the action, looks like this. I'm going to run it like that. So, as you just said, this thing has an SON global symmetry. It doesn't have an SON local symmetry, but I can get an SON local symmetry by replacing derivative by covariant derivative. Okay, so, if we introduce A, I, J is a background gauge field, and we can study this expression, where okay, so chi is a parameter for gauge transformations. Then this is gauge invariant. where phi and a transform phi delta phi I is chi j I e phi a b, and delta a minus del t I plus I A. So if you look at the point is that the covariant derivative transforms as commutator. So if you go through the algebra, this is invariant. So this is answering your question. So I want to derive this formula in this example and see that if we go through what we did before, we find that the Hamiltonian has this extra term adjoined to it. This is going to be very easy. So firstly, what's the phase space? Well, you're going to take coordinates on it. Qi, which is the value of phi I at 0, and pi, which is the covariant derivative of phi. Just as before. So it's important in this discussion that A is a background field. So when I look at the equations in motion to study the phase space, you don't vary A. The equation coming from varying A is only important if A is a dynamical gauge. But because we're not doing that, everything is pretty much the same as before. So this is our phase space, the symplectic form. This same as before. EQI wedge DPI.
Yeah. Sorry, quick question. There are two indices on the A, so like the upper index, the little a, this corresponds to the generators of the gauge group. And then the small indices ij, this corresponds to the manifold.
No, sorry, sorry for the confusion. So I'm specializing to the gauge group SON. So therefore the generators of the gauge group are given by anti-symmetric matrices.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So the
ij corresponds to the gauge group.
And the manifold it lives on is just one dimensional, so there's no really need to specify that coordinate. Yeah.
So what do you mean by chi as parameter for gauge transformation? Is that the real numbers you assign to each basis?
Well, the infinitesimal gauge transformation is like an element of the gauge algebra for each point in time. That element. Yep.
I'm a bit confused by why A is not varied. So I'm thinking about gravity, for example, where the detachment is independent.
Yes.
But then on the shell, there's the connection turns out to be the spin connection. So why would I be able to integrate A similarly in this way?
You can and should integrate A at the end of the day. But it's also a reasonable thing to consider, you know.
Should we prove those or just
games? It's a reasonable physical question to consider how this field phi behaves in the presence of some background. So, I think this is something we encounter in everyday life. You know, you have some electromagnetic field which you treat purely classically, direction. You don't try to study QED, but then you study things moving in it. But it is true that this is kind of a warm-up case, and at the end, I do want to, you know, I want to study the phase space of Yang-Mills theory, so I ultimately want to make eight analytical.
I'm sorry, I don't understand where we got the transformations.
Oh, I just, let's see, so this is a vector, so vectors should just transform by rotation.
Okay, and x was our...
x at each point in x, each point in time, x is a matrix. Which, so all I'm saying here is this transforms as a vector under that one.
Okay.
And this transformation is less obvious, but this kind of is the transformation properties of gauge fields. And to see, you know, this equation kind of tells you why it's the right thing.
You said your chi ij is the parameter for gauge transformations, which is what you're using to as your gauge transformation. But you say this is gauge invariant. What do you mean by that?
I mean that if I vary these guys, if I look at my Lagrangian, and I vary every quantity in it in this way, you get zero.
Oh, you said this is gauge invariant. You meant that I thought you meant the gauge transform itself is gauge invariant, which is
no. Sorry, no. I meant that the Lagrangian.
And what was the formalism behind finding these? You just, is this trial and error or something? How did you find the delta as to transform like this? It's like adding QFD, I suppose, but.
Right. So the origin of it is that, like, the fundamental thing is not A. The real quantity you should be thinking about is the covariant derivative. And all I'm saying is the covariant derivative transforms in the most obvious way. It's a matrix. It transforms as a matrix.
But why did delta A change like that? Why is it?
Well, because the covariant derivative is d by dt plus A. So if you use this equation and figure out how A is to transform to make this equation hold, you'll get this equation.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because when you do the commutator with of chi with d by dt, you pick up this term. You see.
Somehow I remember the gauge transformation, like, because you wrote del t chi, but I remember, like, it's like you only written as g inverse del t g.
Yeah, this is the small gauge transformation still to the identity, and you're looking, that formula is for the exponentiated form, the large gauge transformation. If you take that formula and take g near the identity, it'll become this.
I don't know, probably I should have known this, but why do we have two flows like XA and XB, and their commutation gives you an XC, like the thing that you wrote there?
Mm-hmm.
Why should we have for each of the, what should we have necessary? Oh, actually, you proved this. What should we have? Why should the commutation of those give you another X? Which also should give you a current. I mean, I understood when you have the commutation relation, you said if you write XF, a commutation with XG is equivalent to X.
Yes. Yes.
F and G, so therefore that's
mm-hmm.
current. But I mean the other way around. Why is the commutation of those X's have the same properties of the first X and the second X?
So you're saying you could imagine a situation where the commutators of your two x's was not associated to any charge at all?
The xf and xg are flows along which Hamiltonian is conserved, but
mm-hmm.
the commutation of those doesn't give you a flow along which Hamiltonian is conserved. Is that
no?
That
they
never happen. But why?
That happens because of the Jacobi identity.
Oh. Oh yeah.
Wait, why? I don't understand.
Yeah.
So there's an identity saying that this is equal to x f x h x g plus another term. H. And both of these terms vanish.
On the level of classical mechanics, the new Hamiltonian, which is the Hamiltonian, the gauge field with the charges.
Mm-hmm.
On the level of classical mechanics, is there any difference between that and just writing a Hamiltonian function and local coordinates p and q? Because I ask this because the charges themselves will be some function of coordinates.
No, you're right. This is just a totally ordinary new Hamiltonian, which depends on some parameters, and I've called my parameters A.
Okay.
But, I mean, writing it in the way we did is going to be useful when I think about making A dynamical.
Okay, just one more question about an example. So I thought originally when we gauge a symmetry, right, the whole point of adding the dynamical gauge field was because if you don't make it dynamical, you cannot make the Lagrangian gauge invariant, but invariant under gauge symmetry. So what's happening?
No, it's gauge. So here is a Lagrangian with the background gauge field, and it's gauge covariant, meaning if I apply a gauge transformation, the Lagrangian changes to the Lagrangian with a different background gauge field related in this way.
So in this case, the Lagrangian is gauged invariant and not just covariant.
I'm being a little. I think my sentence here was a little sloppy. I mean, as a function of phi and a, it is invariant under these transformations. Now, if I was to fix my value of a, and treat it just as a function of phi. Of course, it's not invariant because A becomes something else when I transform. Okay. So let's finish the analysis and see where we were. It's all very easy. I'm going to declare that my P's are not the derivatives, but the covariant derivatives. And then the symplectic form is dP dQ. So let's think about how things evolve in time. Well, the covariant derivative of q is equal to p, and the covariant derivative of pi is equal to 0. This comes from the equations of motion, which is that dt squared pi equal to 0. So we see this just by looking at the Lagrangian and varying phi, integrating by parts. So what this tells us is, well, Hamiltonian is the thing telling us about ordinary time derivative and not covariant derivative. So let's figure this out. The time derivative of pi, qi, is equal to pi minus aijj, and time derivative of pi is equal to minus aijj. And this should be Hamiltonian UI. And this should be Hamiltonian with DI. So now we can kind of see what the Hamiltonian is. ETQ equals P, that always gives us the usual P squared term in the Hamiltonian. We're going to have that. And then there's going to be another term. We have this EI UJ is delta IJ. So what's the other term? It's going to be like AIJ EIQJ. Plus or minus? That's a minus. Let me check the signs. Yeah, signs look. Signs look correct. So maybe I got a minus sign wrong compared to what we did before, or mu ij is pi ij. These are currents for angular momentum. Okay, so I don't know how illuminating this example was.
Sorry, I don't quite understand how we got the Hamiltonian from this. I mean, I guess we probably expanded out the long brackets and compared, but I don't know, it's...
And what we did... We took the covariant derivative, and we said covariant derivative is ordinary derivative plus something involving A.
Yeah.
And then ordinary, so then we moved the stuff involving A to the other side.
Yeah, but then getting to the Hamiltonian.
We just expanded out kind of, we just expanded out the Poisson bracket PI QJ with QI. You want to guess something whose Poisson bracket with QI is QJ, and yeah, QJ is a good. We'll do that for you.
Okay. In this case, we would have that if we put all the angular momentum together, it would behave as a vector.
Is it again?
Like, if we take if we have the instead of the field theory, just a particle, and we take the three quantities. And we put them in a vector, it behaves as a vector.
Yes.
Does it mean that A index in mu is a vector index sometimes?
So,
it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so what you're describing is something that is special to dimension 3 in the group SO3, and that the adjoint representation is the same as the vector representation. I mean, that's the statement that, you know, every rotation has an axis in dimension 3 and it doesn't in other dimensions. Yeah.
So, okay, so I see how you'd go about finding the Hamiltonian, although it's quite messy, but then you go and you've got a line with mu ij, and I think, and then from there, I guess you're were saying mu ij equals p I q j.
Yeah.
How did we get the mu ij in the first place to be in that line?
Oh, how did I know these were? Okay, so the thing I didn't say was, now if you could take this, picture given by Giuseppe about Noether's theorem saying, well, every symmetry has a conserved charge.
Right. Oh, okay. Okay.
Like,
so we're saying the these
are
times the A, it's got
to
be.
Yeah. But if you were to go and figure out what is the conserved charge for a rotation of the piece, it's that.
Okay. Wait, what do you mean go work out?
If you look at how Giuseppe formulated Noether's theorem, saying if I have a symplectic manifold with a symmetry, then there's a charge associated to that symmetry.
Okay.
You say, well, my symmetry is rotating the p's.
Right.
What's the charge? That's the charge.
Okay.
Yeah, but the other ones.
So you mean, since aij helps with our rotations, we need whatever it's multiplying it to?
Well, so the statement was like, if we take a Lagrangian with the background gauge field and we work out what it is in the Hamiltonian formalism, then my gauge field is coupled to the Noether charges.
Okay.
So we figured out what the gauge field is coupled to. It's this PIQJ. And
why can't it be like coupled to multiple things? Like, couldn't maybe QJ is coupled to AIJ? And then it's that whole term is like multiplied by something else, and you say, oh, okay, only part of it could be a Noether graph. I mean, in this case, it's not, but because it wouldn't make sense for just Q to be a Noether current. But still, why do we assume it's only coupled to the Noether current?
Well, it turns out to be that in practice. I mean, it's really tightly constrained by the symmetry properties. A transforms in the adjoint representation, so whatever it's coupled to must be something transforming in the adjoint representation.
Oh, okay.
To understand the symmetry of the system, you can just gauge the system and see how the dimension.
Yes.
By the charge.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, this is. It might be helpful to say. If you were to work at a more fancy context, some higher dimensional quantum field theory, then people might not use this formulation of Noether's theorem, and the charge is defined to be the thing that couples to the gauge field. That's really the fundamental definition of the charge. We saw before that there's a first order picture.
Sorry, can I ask a,
yeah.
I don't think it's trivial, but it might be pedantic. But if DTQI is the Poisson recognized on HNQ, which it is, and DTPI is, and if you write that down for the first term, you get it minus DHDP, and for the second term, you get a DHDQ.
Yes.
And if you want to solve those equations from the second equation, you get a minus AIJP, PJQI. But from the first term, you get a plus AIJ.
Yeah, AIJ is an anti-symmetric matrix.
Oh.
Yeah, because it's in SOI, I should have said that.
Oh. Yeah, now it works out.
Remember this picture we had? Or if I could go from a first order Lagrangian, and the first order Lagrangian involved a path moving in the phase space. The second order Lagrangian was whatever I might have started with. I build a phase space, and look at something having a path moving in the phase space, and these are equivalent by integrating out some auxiliary fields. So this Lagrangian here was So if I have a symplectic manifold, I'm going to assume, as we were doing, that the symplectic form is D of alpha. You can build a Lagrangian modeling that system by this formula. Integral of gamma star of alpha plus the Hamiltonian times dt. So how do we do this when there's gauge symmetry? Well, we've just figured this out. When we couple to a gauge field, we get, we change the first order Lagrangian to where UA are the Noether currents, and AA are one-forms on OR. So this usual second order, first order picture we discussed, if I make these derivatives covariant, I'm adding on this term. So we want to study what happens if A is made dynamical. How does the phase space change?
You said A is fully anti-symmetric because in your example,
that example of it
was a member of SON.
Yes.
How did you figure that out, though, before you did any calculations?
Oh, because I knew, you know, I'm on ORN, and I want to have some symmetries, which are some rotations, and they need to preserve the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is P squared, so they need to preserve that inner product. Has to be S squared. Okay. So to make A dynamical, we do two things. Firstly, we vary A to get a new equation of motion. And we also say, well, you know, in a gauge theory with a dynamical gauge field, field configurations related by a gauge transformation are equivalent two points, we say two points in the phase space which are related by a transformation are equivalent.
Wait, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't understand the setup, but it, when, wouldn't two points in phase space related by gauge transformation always be equivalent whether A is dynamical or not?
No, when A is a background gauge field, you don't view two things as related by gauge transformation as equivalent.
Why is that? I really thought, you know, a gauge transformation doesn't change any physical properties of your system, and the phase space is essentially your physical system, right? Is this the confusion? Is this like the terminology of gauge transformation?
Well, let's do an example. If we're considering an ordinary field theory, mm-hmm. we don't couple to gravity. I mean, we treat gravity as a background field. We're not doing quantum gravity, but, you know, we're standing on the Earth. We're in a gravitational field.
Okay.
Gravity has diffeomorphism gauge symmetry. In everyday electromagnetism, we don't treat two things related to bi-coordinate changes being the same.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. Well, like, the universe, the world is static. There's a static gravitational field and stuff moving in it.
Wait, sorry, say that again. What are we not treating?
Diffeomorphism symmetry is the gauge symmetry of gravity.
Yes.
So we don't, when we work in quantum field theory, even with a background metric, we don't treat diffeomorphism symmetry as a gauge symmetry.
Because it's talking about gravity and not what...
Yeah, exactly. The gravitational field might have some effect on the particles moving through it, but it's just fixed and static. And it's the same here.
But here, are we working with multiple theories? Like, we've got field theories, and then we have background.
So when we have a background field, we have, you know, some gauge fields, which is fixed and static and never changing, and stuff moving through it.
I'm still... sure, I understand. So we're introducing two theories here. I'm talking about fixed gauge field one, and then we're talking about the other theory.
Well, let's see. So in the path integral formulation, so we're starting life with some, you know, free field coupled to a gauge field, and my gauge field is fixed. And I'm doing a path integral only varying my scalar field.
Okay.
And then I can also say, well, what happens if I then vary my gauge field as a second step? And that's this thing we're considering here, making the gauge field dynamical. It's only in the second step that you have to be careful to identify two things which are related by gauge transformations.
But for instance, going on your question, if you have a particle charged to an electromagnetic field, the usual case, then the equations of motion of the particle are the Lorentz force law. Is that the name? The Lorentz force law, and that's invariant under gauge transformations of A, no?
Yeah.
So in that sense, there is the invariance.
Yes, but the Hilbert space of that particle might be a representation of my gauge symmetry group, and I don't. There you go. The phase space of that particle, I suppose my gauge field was zero. The Hilbert space of an electron or something is a representation of the group U1. And I don't look at gauge invariant quantities there.
Just terminology track. So the first order Lagrangian, right? This is defined after you pull back to the real line from phase space, right? So
yes.
Here the connection one formula somewhat lifting it up to the phase space rather than the.
No. It's all in the real line because I'm pulling back these northern currents too.
Yeah. So now the next question is, what does mu a along a path here means? Because
The mu is just a function.
Function on phase space.
Exactly.
now we prescribe a path.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So I want to say a little bit about what happens when we vary A. So when we vary A, clearly, we find that the moment map, mathematicians call this the moment map, is mu A, the north of charges, is zero. So when we couple to a dynamical gauge field, we change our phase space first by setting the moment map to zero.
Why is the charge zero?
Well,
current, yeah.
If we look in the Lagrangian, there's like A times north of current. So if I vary A, get that zero.
Why? Is it because the current has to stay constant and if?
No, it's because the phase space is the space of solutions to the equations of motion. And now I've added on an extra equation, so I made my phase space smaller.
So it has to be zero or else we have too many equations?
No, I'm just looking at this Lagrangian, or indeed, let's look at this Lagrangian. It's a bit more complicated in the second order formalism. Anything? And I just, by varying phi, I get an equation involving the second derivative of phi as being something.
Okay.
That gives me my usual phase space.
Uh-huh.
But if I vary A, I get some new equations.
Okay, and what's wrong
with that? Nothing, I'm just imposing those equations.
Wait, sorry, what was the last thing you said?
I'm just imposing the equations you get by varying A.
Why does it give you that mu is zero?
Because A, in this way of writing the Lagrangian, A is just multiplied by mu. So if I vary A, I get mu.
Is that
equal
to zero?
Oh.
The way that it's equal to zero is mu is equal to zero.
Okay. Okay.
So the old phase space, and gets transformed into something called the reduced phase space. M modulo G. And this is defined in two steps. We've looked at the first step by one, we look at the set. It'll write mu inverse of zero. The points where all of the north of charges vanish. And two, we make an equivalence relation. If x, y are such that mu a of x is zero, mu a of y is zero, and x is gy. For some element of the group, then we identify them. Have you guys seen this kind of construction before?
Equivalence relations?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, wait, you mean this specific one?
Well, not maybe not the specific one, but. So another way to say it is. So x modulo g, this it's called a symplectic reduction, is equal to the set of g orbits in this locus. So this second step comes because two points in phase space related by a gauge transformation need to be treated as the same. This construction is always going to be present when you want to study the phase space of a gauge theory.
Question about the variation of Lagrangian. At the level of Lagrangian, don't you need to change relate p's and q's using covariant derivatives? Why would the when you take the variation of a, wouldn't there be a's in the covariant derivatives?
Yeah, that's why it's easier to do in the first order formulation.
Like, is there a reason why we can just ignore the, can just treat p and q as independent in this, like, in the variation space?
You can try and derive this reduced phase space from either the first order formulation or the second order formulation. So I thought from the first order formulation, I thought it was quite clear. Are you happy with the first order derivation or? Yeah. So the question is, like, suppose I was to take something like this Lagrangian and look at the equations of motion involving varying a. That's a little more complicated for the reason you said that the a appears quadratically in this expression. That's why I thought it was easier to do this.
I thought the only difference is that you change the Hamiltonian into a new form. You attach the Hamiltonian with A alpha.
In this one, we've added on an auxiliary field called P or something. And there's a term P squared and P times covariant derivative of Q. So when I write it in the first order formulation, A only appears linearly and never quadratically. It's only when you integrate out P does the quadratic appearance of A appear. So this is easier.
When we make our gauge field dynamical, it seems like we lose the global charges that we had.
Yes.
I'm a bit confused about that. For example, if we take just ordinary Lorentzian symmetry, let's say we have momentum conservation, considering, let's say, electromagnetism, why would we lose, for example, momentum conservation?
What?
The gauge field dynamical.
So in that case, the momentum is part of gravity. Right? So when I have a gauge field in ordinary electric. In ordinary electromagnetism, the gauge field might be U1, and the thing it's coupled to is electric charge and not momentum. So when I make that gauge field dynamical, you only see kind of uncharged objects. in the Hilbert space. If I was to couple to gravity, so the momentum is associated to translations in space, or space-time, so those are part of the diffeomorphism group, and when I couple to gravity, those will go away. So the question of like what is the Hamiltonian of gravity is a really fraught question.
In the beginning of the class, we started with considering the Lie algebra.
Yes.
But now you wrote G is the group instead of the algebra. Is something, is that relevant or not?
Oh, it's Lie algebras and groups are very closely related. If I have a continuous group, you get the Lie algebra by looking at things near the identity matrix. Conversely, if you have the Lie algebra, you can take exponentials and get the group back. You know, like just matrix exponentials.
But would this be the same? Like there are some different groups that have the same Lie algebra?
Yes. So I was maybe being a little sloppy about the distinction. For this construction here, forming the reduced phase space, it's better to use the group.
So just to reiterate this condition that the inverse of these current parameters, so in some sense we look at a subset of the equations of motion, which are the ones that are non-dynamical and come from variant A.
Yes.
And once we're on this constrained hypersurface, then
exactly.
We have more equivalence of solutions.
Exactly. And there's so the term people use for this is the symplectic quotient, symplectic reduction, Marsden-Weinstein reduction sometimes. So I don't think I can go much further, but I wanted to maybe quickly state a theorem, and we can try to get our hands on this next time. In good cases, the symplectic reduction, I call it M. We're calling it M dot X. Is again a symplectic manifold. So maybe I don't have time to go through this right now, but for example, you know, symplectic manifolds are always even dimensional. Suppose I take the group to be U1. If I take the group to be U1, then I am imposing one equation, reducing the dimension by one. But then I'm also imposing a one-dimensional equivalence relation, reducing the dimension by one again. So when the group is U1, this procedure reduces the dimension by 2, making it kind of plausible that it is still symplectic.
If the group reduces the phase spaces that the U phase space is all dimensional, can we still say that it is a Poisson manifold, might not be symplectic?
Yeah, but you don't want that to happen, really. I mean, typically This procedure will always produce you something simple. Yes.
Is there an easy way to see that this quotient, right, effectively remove the zero modes of the symplectic form? Do I have to go to the Poisson bracket and then somehow convert the inverse of the symplectic and stuff?
So is there an easy way to see?
This procedure effectively construct a new symplectic manifold where the symplectic form no longer have the zero modes, right? But is there an easy way to see why step two is the same as that?
I think the way to do it is just to work in, you work in coordinates, and you assume you're working in a coordinate patch where these guys look nice. Maybe they look linear or something. And you notice that this equivalence relation, I mean, these group transformations are the transformations generated by these charges. They're closely related. So you just by working in coordinates, you notice that you're removing a pair of, when you do this procedure, you're removing a pair of canonically conjugate variables.
Could you explain a little bit about how the first and second condition is related to gauge fixing condition on usual
form theory? Gauge fixing? Yeah, I think if I was being very careful about this, which I kind of wasn't because we were running out of time, you could object that, I'm just imposing an equivalence relation for the global symmetries and not for the gauge transformations. So secretly what's going on is that I'm choosing a Lorentz gauge, or d by dt of a is zero, and that breaks all gauge symmetries except for the global transformations. So we can say first work in Lorentz gauge that forces a to be constant, then we get the moment map equation and divide by the gauge symmetry. So if I didn't work in Lorentz gauge, you might have thought, oh, my phase space might be much bigger because shouldn't there be things in the phase space corresponding to all possible values of A and its derivatives? Because A itself does not actually satisfy any equations. But those are unphysical. You can see this either by using the Lorentz gauge, in which case they're all gone, or by noting that they're kind of canceled with the other gauge transformations.
Is there a way to understand the covariant derivative as a vector field on the symplectically reduced map?
Say it again, sorry.
So the covariant derivative associated to A.
Yes.
Is there a way to understand it as a vector field over some map? I guess similar to how we do it for just a regular partial derivative.
The way to think about that, the language people use for that is instead of a vector field, A describes a connection on a vector bundle. So a connection is a way of lifting a vector field on my manifold upstairs to the vector bundle. So in that case, yes. I have my space-time, above it there's a vector bundle. You have a vector field downstairs, you can lift it up to one using A. And so get a vector field an upstairs manifold, and that is the covariant derivative.
Maybe two questions regarding. So I was thinking originally that the G was a gauge transformation, actually. So
it is for every
instant in time. So it can be done without imposing the Lorentz gauge in a way. Also, if we make it local.
Yes, you can. And I was kind of skipping over this point. So yeah. Suppose you were to take this Lagrangian and look at its solutions to the equations of motion. It's something gigantic because A does not satisfy any constraints at all. It also has a gigantic gauge symmetry. And those cancel. And then you're left out of this situation again.
Okay. And the second question would be, what was the motivation again for starting this entire endeavor in the sense of I've... I'm trying to find some analog in what we have done in physics before, and I'm struggling to find it. Like, why gauging at this level without any dynamics for the A field, actually?
Oh, well, suppose you were to take Yang-Mills theory. It has dynamical gauge fields, and you put it on S3 times OR, and you do Kaluza-Klein reduction.
We put it on, S3 times R?
Yeah. And you do Kaluza-Klein reduction, you'll find, like, the point of the gauge, it will look exactly like this. What I'm calling A is now just the point of the gauge field pointing along time. The other components of the gauge field then become interpreted as matter fields when I do the KK reduction.
Sorry, I missed a few words in there, but
So the other components of the gauge field, kind of vertical pointing ones, they behave now like matter fields in the perspective of the one dimensional system.
I just missed a few words. Something becomes matter fields from the perspective of the
one dimensional system.
Yeah.
So I take my 4D system, and I reduce it to the real life.
Which is 4D because we have time plus the internal rotating degrees of freedom of the gauge group.
No, it was 4D because I'm studying just ordinary Yang-Mills theory on S3 times time.
Okay, in a sphere, we're in a space, okay.
4D, and I'm just reducing to the real line. And if you compute what you get, and you'll find it will look a lot like this.
And why would we then go to this side and try to mod out the...
Well, suppose I wanted to figure out what is the phase space of classical QCD. This is what you do.
Okay.
I mean, it's like this, but some very big infinite dimensional.
Okay, I'll think about it.